We will be having a series in the spring, as we usually do, and I want to tell you before introducing tonight's speaker that the lead-off speaker, January the 15th, will be Michael Adams, the author of the best-selling comparison between American and Canadian culture, Fire and Ice. Michael Adams is the president of the polling company Environics. Tonight's speaker is Karen Connolly, one of Canada's best known and most successful younger writers. She is the author of 7 books of nonfiction, fiction, and poetry. She has read from her work and lectured in Canada, Europe, and Australia, and Asia, and her long-awaited first novel, Lizard Cage, is now out, published in Canada, and you can buy a copy if you wish to in the lobby at the end of this lecture tonight. And you will sign it, won't you, if they come to you? For a price. She'll sign the signed books down here if you wish to bring a book for her to sign. She identified as a writer very early in her life, and at 17 she won a scholarship as a Rotary exchange student to Thailand, and that was the beginning of her very successful career, which included travel books and poetry, and notes about how the world operates in many places. She has lived in the North African quarter of Avignon. She has lived in Spain. She has a home in Greece. At the present time, however, she's living in Toronto with her husband of only 2 months. In 1993, Karen made a spectacular entrance onto the Canadian literary stage. Her book about Thailand, Touch the Dragon, a Thai journal, won the country's highest honor for nonfiction writing, the Governor General's Award. At just 24, Connolly became the youngest winner of this prestigious award. Touch the Dragon went on to become a national bestseller, remaining on the bestseller lists for almost 2 years, and then continuing to garnish very high praise in Britain, Australia, Germany, Taiwan, and eventually the United States. I'm very happy to introduce you to Karen Connolly.
Thank you so much. And I would like to thank Pat for all her work on behalf of the Vancouver Institute. I learned today that it is 90 years old, this lecture series, this institute. And I would also really like to thank Hector for tracking me down in my many peregrinations and saying to me every couple of years that he would really like me to come and speak to the Vancouver Institute. So I'm really pleased to finally be here. And of course, I thank you all for coming this evening. And excuse me while I drink water in front of you all. It's always such an awkward moment. So tonight, I'm going to be departing from my usual just talking or just reading or just showing photographs. I'm going to mix those three forms up. And bear with me, therefore, it's a bit of an experiment. And I don't usually show slides. As you will notice, that is not, in fact, a full slide. These photographs, most of them, all but two or three of them, are in fact part of an exhibition. So the photos are 11 by 14 and the pieces themselves are 20 by 24. and ideally they're meant to be seen in a gallery space. But because images have been really important in my Burmese work in these last few years, and because the pictures themselves have meant so much to me, I wanted to share them with people in the audience. So they look a bit, they don't look as pretty as they look in a gallery. So here I am. And it will be a pleasure to talk this evening to people about Burma and writing this book, The Lizard Cage, this novel set in Burma. But before I talk about Burma and before I talk about the book, I want to approach this lecture, this discussion, which for me really is a conversation, a kind of ongoing conversation, from the border, from the edge. It's almost impossible for me to really think about Burma without thinking about the border. I first went to Burma in 1996, and that's where I started to meet Burmese people. But after about a year of trips into Burma, I was unable to get a visa because of taking photographs, because of interviewing certain political figures. So I went to the border, the Thai-Burmese border. And much of my research for the novel ended up being done with the men and women who live on the Thai side of the Thai-Burma border and who are working activists and dissidents. So this is a group of people, a significant group of people, a significantly large group of people who are doing work against the military regime of Burma from the outside in. And along with those people, there are many, many refugees on the Thai-Burmese border. And those people, of course, have been living there, some of them for over 10 years, some of them for over 15 years now. And the border is as much a state of mind as it is a place. Against their choosing, forced by violent political upheaval, these people have become illegal migrants in a new and a sometimes hostile world, that world on the other side of the border. I've spent a lot of time thinking about that state of mind and that place, the border. In some ways, it's become, and it always was, I suppose, less exotic, less foreign than the word Burma. And it's an easier way for me to talk about Burma because I've noticed that occasionally people, particularly when it's a smaller group and I can see everybody's eyes, people will kind of get this glaze about them when I launch into a discussion about Burma, because there's not much of a place for it in the popular imagination. We don't know very much about Burma. It's very far away. You know, we hear a lot more about places like, of course, China or India or even Thailand. And those are countries that all share very significant borders with the country of Burma. The reason I keep calling it Burma instead of Myanmar is because it was the military government who changed the name. And people who do activist work, both inside the country and on the border, continue to call the country Burma. They don't use the military's new name. I think for all of us, the border has become a much realer place, a much more solid place than it used to be post 9/11. If only because suddenly that long undefended border that we share with the United States is no longer so undefended. It is much less permeable than it used to be, even for Canadians. Just a couple of weeks ago, I was on my way to New York, and to my surprise, I had my travel documents and my plane ticket confiscated. I mean, confiscated, they were taken away from me, so I guess the formal word for that is confiscation. And I was taken to a small room where there were a lot of other people sitting. Strangely enough, most of them had darker skin than mine. And I waited for almost an hour to get my passport and my travel documents back. And I was asked about the stamps in my passport. And curiously enough, the worst stamp in my passport and the one that was most confusing to the American customs officials was the American stamp in my passport, a student visa. They actually called the university to verify that I had been studying there 2 summers ago. And in fact, because I hadn't paid my American health insurance, the university said that I had checked in, but I had never finished the course. So that's why I was being grilled about what I was really doing in America. And of course, I was studying Burmese. So, you know, I realized that it really is that. It is a place that we can be stopped. And I want to do exactly that. I want to stop at that word. And just have you in the audience think about the meaning of the word border and what the border means to you. I would just like to ask people to think about a time or a place or a state even in your lives when there has been another side for you, when you have been stopped at something. And what was the other side like? If you are holding in your mind a physical country or place, was it dirtier on the other side? Was it cleaner? Was it hard to understand what people were saying? Was it harder to understand yourself on that border? In all these peregrinations that I've been making for a long time around the world, staying in places, feeling like I lived often on borders, I've come to realize that the hardest frontiers really to cross are those ones that we have in our minds, in our skins. When I was having this conversation about borders with a friend a couple of weeks ago, just thinking about this talk that I was going to give tonight, he said that the hardest frontier, the hardest border he had ever lived on or paused at, was the one that he lived on when he was thinking very seriously about leaving his wife. And then I started thinking about borders in emotional terms, and I thought how we inhabit a terrible border when someone we love has betrayed us, or what happens, how we live on a border when we have betrayed someone. I think that creates a border within us that's as strong as the Great Wall of China. So, what is your border? Did you cross it, or was it too late, or too soon, or too dangerous? We don't even need to leave our city to find very powerful physical borders. If we follow Main Street east in Vancouver, down that long sloping hill, we enter Chinatown, another world, other languages, other people. You know, what is all that food in those bins outside of the shops? And how do they eat it? You know, what do you have to do to consume those mysterious foods? And some of us are, of course, brave enough to venture that far, to go across those borders. But there is in that area in Vancouver a further border that most of us tend to shy away from. We don't want to consider, to learn, to feel anything more than ideally apathy or pity, or even a kind of protective revulsion for the crack and heroin addicts, or for the women who sell their bodies to get the money for those drugs. Marnie Frey, Serena Abbotsford, Heather Bottomley. We prefer to pretend that those women had no names. Sherry Irving, Patricia Rose Johnson, Angela Jardine. So when they started to disappear, 5 of them, 10 of them, 15 of them, 22 of them, 27, over 30 women, we could rightly claim that we had never seen them in the first place. They were invisible to us. Georgina Faith Papin, Mona Wilson, Inga Hall. Those are the names of dead women, but their living sisters are invisible still. I thought a lot about those women when I lived in Vancouver because I was working on this novel about Burma, about people who we don't see. Those people who live in prisons are also invisible to us, whether they are political prisoners or criminal prisoners. We don't see them, and we don't look for them. But working on this novel about a man who lives in prison, I was forced to look inside, to think about prisons, the meanings of them, how humans build them and maintain them. And I spent a lot of time talking to and getting to know and listening to people who had lived in prison. So let's see how well this works. Okay, it doesn't. I'm pushing all the forwards. Ah, bravo. So, that is one of my prison photographs. As you can see, they have text, but please don't strain your eyes trying to read them because I think it's just too far away. This is actually a friend of mine on the border, a poet, a writer, and lately, for the last 12 years, a dissident, an activist. His name is Goluani. The Lizard Cage tells the story of someone who is like Goluani, but someone who chose to stay in Burma. His name is Teza. He's a political prisoner who is jailed for writing and singing songs that are critical of Burma's military regime. Teza and his brother in the novel take part in the democracy uprisings of 1988, which was a very real series of protests and demonstrations. Students led those protests against the dictatorship, and they eventually spread to millions of people in all walks of life across Burma. Millions of people. It was a galvanizing time in Burmese history. When the military responded to those protesters by slaughtering hundreds, then thousands of them in the streets, Teza's brother chooses to leave Burma. He travels into the jungle and joins one of the ethnic armies on the border. Along with thousands of other students, he becomes an armed revolutionary. Some of these men, as you can see, were incredibly young. And for the most part, a lot of them were university students and high school students. Really, in some ways, middle-class kids. So they were very, very unprepared for the rigors, the challenges, and the various disasters that befell them as guerrilla soldiers. Oops. And of course, landmines were a big part of everyone's life on the border, and some of them, as well, of course, as the ethnic populations that were fighting alongside them and living alongside them in the jungle. Many of these people lost life or limb to the landmines. Both sides of this conflict, of course, all sides of this conflict, as there have been several over the last few decades, have been sowing landmines up and down those borders. And those young revolutionaries, oops, those young revolutionaries were preceded by, I wasn't going to say migrant workers, but I will. That's the slide. They were preceded, of course, by and followed by an enormous population of refugees. And the refugees have been followed by young women who have been sold into prostitution. And out of desperation, Thailand and India also have many economic migrants, like this boy, really, working in Thailand on one of countless building sites across the country, you know, very vulnerable to everything that people are vulnerable to when they are illegal migrants. I can hear it clicking in the back room. I will turn on the light.
Check into it.
Ta-da. So living on the border and seeing and being close to these various populations of people who were in their different ways quite desperate. Obviously, living in such a place and spending time with those people led me to ask a lot of questions. Questions that I still ask myself. What am I willing to see? What am I capable of seeing? What am I willing to feel? How well can I know this world that I live in, this world that I love? I ask myself these questions often, and the answers often are very humbling. I would often turn away from the novel that I was writing, this novel about a young political prisoner, simply because it was too difficult. You know, the world of it was too hard. But it was these photographs, some of which you've seen, I'm not sure, voilà. It was these photographs that would bring me back to the work, because they would speak to me, and they simply said, you know, don't turn away. You know, we may be refugees, we may be political prisoners, we may be people who live under this brutal system of government or who have been scarred by it. But look at us. Don't stop seeing us. Your seeing is part of our humanity also. So this is a Karen woman in a refugee camp in Thailand. And this is actually a refugee camp that has been burnt down by Burmese soldiers, which is and was particularly in the early and mid-90s very common. The Burmese refugees lived even though they lived in Thailand as refugees, they lived very close to the border. And Burmese soldiers, there were often incursions onto this Thai territory by Burmese soldiers. And the Thai government and the Thai military just turned a blind eye, and the soldiers would burn down the refugee camps. That happened year after year. Oops. There we go. Trying to turn on the lights. The problem, of course, with seeing is particularly seeing things that are painful or difficult to see, is that it just takes so much energy. And I find that as I get older, and of course I was aging as I wrote this book, it took me a decade to write, I found that I just didn't have as much energy as I had when I was younger and when I was more open somehow to even to what I was doing on my own, what I was choosing to do. And then, of course, it takes even more labor to actually respond, not to just see or to listen, but to act out of compassion or to act in the activist sense. And to respond compassionately to people's suffering was something that I had, in writing this novel, chosen to do. And I realized over the years that it was a very, very difficult task, and I wondered why I had chosen to do this thing. I realized that a lot of the time, not only was I not interested in other people's suffering and struggles, but I wasn't even particularly interested in my own. I did not want to know how I was feeling, partly because this work that I was doing sometimes just made me absolutely furious about the way the world is, or it made me extremely sad. But seeing and then acting with compassion surprised me as well. It's a labor that has turned out to be paid for with rather unexpected gifts. In some ways, it's a little bit like kayaking. And I promise I'm not going to show you any kayaking slides from my last trip. I don't know what it's like. I mean, I'm presuming there are some other people in the audience who are kayakers, seeing as we are in Vancouver. And I don't know what you're like, but I am a lazy kayaker. And, you know, before a kayaking trip, I'm often rather grumpy, and I don't really want to do it all. I don't want to get out all the gear and the flotation devices and the life jackets and get the paddles ready and organize the food and the clothing and even the transportation is a bit of a hassle. And really, I would prefer to sleep in and eat croissants in the morning and read the book section. But then you get yourself together and you make the effort to do what you have to do. And a few hours later, there you are. Having crossed the border of my own comfort, I find that I am in another world, on the water, in the boat, in the salted air, with birds singing on the shoreline, and my senses are enlivened. Literally, I become more alive as I attend this beauty that's around me. I become more capable of seeing that beauty, and I know the gift of it. I know my own luck to receive such bounty. I am so blessed to be able to see it, to be able to feel it. And I wonder how I could ever have doubted my own effort. And there is that kind of beauty in doing the work that I ended up doing around Burma, around the border. And I think generally, for many people, because of course I sought them out, I talked to people who were doing what would be called good works, I suppose, if we were speaking in religious terms. Life-saving works, I suppose, if we're just thinking about human terms. They also would tell me that they thought they were going to their work, whatever it was, running a woman's shelter, or just working a couple times a week in a soup kitchen, or just helping people in their family that they found particularly frustrating. These people said that they went to this work with a sense of being very generous and giving so much, and they were surprised by how what they did gave to them, how the generosity was in fact reversed. The return of generosity. I have all these things written in my notes on the side because as I was reading this afternoon, various ideas about continuing this talk and deepening it and exploring further this theme were coming to me. And then there's a little note that says, to face the woundedness and vulnerability of others is to face my own woundedness. Or to face my fear of it, that dread of being hurt or broken. Sometimes it's uncomfortable. Sometimes it's terrifying to know your own fragility. Most often that fragility is invisible. We carry it within us like a hidden jewel, or we pretend that it is outside of us. It is over the border where the sick and the maimed people live. But of course, as we all know, that is a border that we all cross eventually, and of course some of us have already crossed over and gone back. And so I have been thinking about that, vulnerability and fragility, and how there's also a gift in that. And I think that that's one of the things that artists do, that remind us that vulnerability is not weakness. It's part of being human. It's part of being able to experience the world. And at the same time, we live in a media culture where vulnerability is also very much a commodity, a morbid fascination. I spent a lot of time in Greece, and it's very strange. It has been very strange for me to come back to Canada, simply because people watch TV here. Where I live in rural Greece, people are not really big TV watchers. The most powerful media on the island where I live is the land. We watch the land, we experience the land, we think about the land, you work the land. Of course, if you have a garden, there's a lot of work involved in that particular media. And that's a media that I've enjoyed experiencing. And so when I came back to Canada a couple of years and started living in a place where there was a television, I was absolutely amazed and shocked and appalled, really, by this passionate fascination with death, with a dissected body, the murdered body, a severed body, usually severed also of any emotional connection. And that has made me wonder that not only those bodies, but also that experience farther back of having spent so much time in Greece and having that media, I call it media just for the sake of comparison, having that media be so much stronger and so much more, of course, lively. And I've wondered if there is a connection between the violated bodies that we see on TV and read about in the newspaper every day, and the violated body of the earth that we live on, this brutalized earth that still sustains and conjoins every one of us. And if there is a connection, then how do we proceed? What do we do? One of my friends on the Thai-Burma border was imprisoned and tortured very badly by the military regime. He left Burma only to end up as a migrant worker in Thailand, where he did back-breaking manual labor until illness after illness ravaged his body. He thought he was going to die, but he didn't. And when he began to remake himself, literally from scratch, he planted a garden. He became a very political journalist who was, and still is, passionately dedicated to gardening, to plants that kill no one. Plants, he once said to me, that conquer by living. That story about my friend is part of a larger history, but it is mostly unwritten, passed over in favor of the history of wars, territories, empires. I think of that unwritten record as the history of kindness, how humans retain and deepen their humanity. I have noticed that this history, like the history of my friend, often involves the participation of the other majority, the plants and animals that are our fellow citizens in this world, the ones who know nothing about our borders, but who have often taught us how to live, what to eat, how to survive so many different climates, even giving us the means, the materials, to do so. While writing The Lizard Cage, I came to believe that the most important thing that I could do as a writer was contribute to that history of kindness. It may seem strange to look for kindness in a prison, but of course, a prison is really just a microcosm of the world that we all live in. The details are very different, but the human struggles and the human needs are exactly the same. To eat, first of all. To be clean and safe. To live with dignity, to live in truth and with choice, to love and be loved, to die with grace. A Burmese prison, any prison really, even a Canadian one, is an extreme environment where fulfilling these needs is very challenging and sometimes not possible. Profound for me and very moving was that so many former political prisoners spoke to me in great detail about the small animals in and near their solitary cells. These creatures, they told me, helped them to remain human. The ants and cockroaches that kept them company, the birds they would feed, the lizards and spiders and rats. They did not anthropomorphize these animals. They had relationships with them. In the course of my research about this prison novel, I read things about prisons all over the world. I read about a prison in the US where a small group of very violent offenders, the worst offenders, the people that we lock our doors against at night, the people we can't really believe live, but of course they do. These men were trying to learn about empathy. They became responsible for a guinea pig. For most of them, it was the first time in their lives that they experienced taking care of another living being. They had themselves never been taken care of. All of them had childhood histories of violent sexual and physical abuse. But they learned to feed, to water, to handle this little animal. They grew, I suppose you could say, to love it, to be able to show concern for its well-being. Over a year later, this guinea pig got sick, and of course the men were upset, and then it died. And so these convicts gathered together and were able to touch its body and to say goodbye. And every one of them wept. They cried and cried. For most of them, it was the first time in their lives they were able to express sadness, to mourn loss, to be human. So some of these pictures are a little bit out of order now that I've continued talking. But these are pictures from Burma. I imagined writing a book about Burma many months before I went there for the first time. I was 26. That year, in 1995, PEN Canada had an honorary member, a Burmese woman my age, who had been imprisoned for writing stories that were critical of the military regime. There were pictures of her in PEN's newsletters, and I could see her face. I put her face on my wall. Like the male character in the novel that I was to write, this young woman had been sentenced to 20 years in solitary confinement. Her name was Ma Thida. We were so close in age, and she was also a writer. Yet our lives were so different. It's the greatest accident in anyone's life, the chance that determines everything, the accident of geography. My curiosity about that accident led me to Burma, led me to talk and meet with Daw Aung San Suu Kyi, the beautiful, diminutive Nobel Peace Prize winner who has faced down an army, who is back again incommunicado under house arrest. How incredible people are that they can be so ill-used, so violated and degraded, and still come out the other side gentle. Aung San Suu Kyi is to me an almost unbelievable example of this. She is genuinely without rancor, without hatred for the men who have imprisoned her again and imprisoned her country for 4 decades. Her patience seems infinite. A devout Buddhist, a staunch believer in Gandhian principles of political action without violence, she still believes, and I quote, that the ultimate revolution is the revolution of the spirit. She also believes that the military dictatorship that rules Burma will change eventually, and I quote again, because all they have are guns. And once, when asked what was going to be, when she was first actually released from the long period of house arrest that she endured in the beginning, which was 6 years, when she was asked by a journalist what now was going to be her modus operandi vis-a-vis the military regime, she said, quite brilliantly, quite poetically, I thought, "I am going to be like a sliver of glass in their hand." In The Lizard Cage, Daan San Suu Kyi plays a central role, though she barely enters into the action of the story. The crucial world in the novel is the prison, the cage, and the crucial events revolve around Teza, the singing-songwriting university student. Unlike his brother, Teza stays in the country, is arrested, and sent to prison. There he befriends the junior jailer, Chitnang, and a boy, a peculiar, extraordinary boy, known as Nile. There he is. This extraordinary boy known as Nile, which just means, in Burmese, little brother. This boy is a child laborer who lives on the prison grounds. Teza, the singer, also becomes close to a criminal prisoner called Seinyun, who promises to help him send a message out of the prison. Paper and pen enter this story just as they enter real Burmese prisons, stealthily, smuggled in like weapons. In the cage, coveted paper and pen become iconic, taking on the power and the danger of talismans. And the lives of Teza and the boy and the senior jailer change irrevocably as those talismans switch hands and the powers that be start to search for them. I'm going to read a scene from the novel in which Teza, the political prisoner, has just finished writing a letter. He has been unsure about whether or not he should write this letter. It has been a miracle that he has received paper and pen, that his server, Seinyun, has helped him. And he promises that he's going to come at 5 o'clock, retrieve the written letter and the pen, both of which are very illegal for Teza to along with the letters of other political prisoners that are being held in the same prison. So all day he waits for Seinyun to come, pacing. And he starts to get very nervous. He stops pacing, drops his head to the side like a puzzled dog. Out loud, he whispers, "What is it?" He doesn't know. He goes still, trying to hear with his body. Only his eyes move back and forth, from the air vent and the spider's web to the door, from one corner to another, crossing, going forward, sweeping back. Sudden wind howls through the tunnel between two buildings. A cry reaches him, as though across an enormous field from a distant part of the prison. He listens for another cry, but hears nothing. Now and then the thunder booms in low tones, like explosions in a rock quarry. A vision flashes into his mind from last night's dream. Living black eyes gaze up at him from inside an ant-filled box, ants crawling everywhere, feasting on the body of the lizard. Tezak crosses to his pile of clothes, takes the letter out, unfolds it. The fine hairs on his arms and neck stand up. He folds the letter over once, holding his breath, holding the edges of the folded paper. He slowly and carefully rips them in half. At first it is easy. The thin layers of paper offer no resistance, though the sound of tearing is like the world leaving him behind. He keeps at it, puts the torn halves back together between his thumbs and index fingers, tearing them again in halves, in quarters, eighths, until the muscles in his hands and forearms cramp with effort. He tears the letter into fragments, a confusion of split words. The smallest pieces escape, slip and flutter from between his fingers, or lift off the neat piles he has set down on the floor in front of him. He carefully gathers them up. Salt sting in his eyes now. He blinks, blinks, squints. He thinks back to St. Yun's mocking question, "What would make you cry?" He shakes his head slowly, back and forth, not knowing why he is doing this. But it does not feel like cowardice. He is not a coward. The iron beater, timekeeper, begins to beat out 5 o'clock. The scraps of paper go soft on his tongue, absorbing saliva easily. When he chews them, they become hard nuggets and hurt his bad teeth, so he tries to keep them small enough to just swallow them down. He wonders if he will be disappointing his comrades, but he feels sure he is not. He feels no guilt as the letter slowly disappears back into his body. Near the far right edge of its web, Comrade Spider sits patiently, waiting for dinner. Teza stops chewing as he stretches his neck to look up at the spider, the air vent just above him. He can smell the coming rain. All the warm muscles and tendons in his neck and upper shoulders are taut. The singer feels the pounding in his throat before he hears it with his ears. It's not the sound of thunder or heaving rain or his heart, but the heavy footsteps of men in the corridor. Half the paper is already in his mouth as he pours the cup of water over the rest of the scraps in his hands, jumps back to the water pot, sloshes more water up to his mouth, swallows, gags, swallows. He coughs, tries to cough quietly. He chews hard to get the paper down more quickly and flinches at the stabbing pain deep in the roots of his bad teeth. It doesn't matter. He moves rapidly in the small space, gracefully, as though he is a dancer and has practiced this many times, the leap back to the blanket where the pen is wrapped up. As he uncovers the pen and crosses the coffin, he listens hard, counting. There are at least 3 men or 4. They are all wearing boots. Voices now. The only thing that matters is the paper he stuffs into his body where everything valuable is hidden, invulnerable. Keep the words away from them, he thinks, and swallows again. The men are halfway down the corridor. The keys jangle and the long chain that holds the key ring rattles and clanks. Is it jailer handsome? Teza cannot tell, but he knows the meaning of those sounds. He has experienced this before, the jailer, and the others coming, that chain. With another gulp of water, the words are gone. The pen in his right hand is poised to the right of his right temple, pointing upward like a dart. He takes aim at the air vent, but he has never played this game with anything bigger than the bits of gravel and the uncooked peas he finds in his daily soup. The sweat gathered on his forehead trickles in rivulets onto his eyelids, into his eyes. He feels sweat on the fingers holding the pen. If he gives in to his fear, he would be weeping, but the brilliant clarity of rage has made him go cold. They are near the door now. The singer holds his tongue between his teeth as he takes aim again. The pen shoots from his fingers, flying upward, but too high. It falls down, narrowly missing the web. He snatches it up again and throws while stepping backwards. How long is a second, a minute, 10 extra years in this cage? The pen seems to float. He thinks it will go through. His shoulders have already relaxed in relief, but it hits the bottom edge of the air vent and drops into the spider's web, tearing through the silk strands and falling to the floor. The small plastic clatter causes a cramp to twist his stomach. What would make you cry? The heavy bolt cracks back hard, that smack of metal against metal, not unlike the smack of bamboo against human bone. Teza, Teza. It's his brother's voice, not his father's, not his mother's. Aumin, his brother, always had the better aim with a slingshot. Stand still, don't back up anymore. And please stop moving. This is your last chance. They will crash through the door in 4, at the most 6 seconds. Close your left eye and aim a little higher. You've always aimed too low. Stop shaking. Now. Tiza exhales a small cry as he lets the pen go. His is not the spear throw of a warrior. It is a full surrender to the realm of absurdity where he lives in the teak coffin and men break into it, where his teeth fall out and the spider's web tears away and his brother whispers to him from a country he's never seen. The key turns in the lock a moment after the pen flies from Teza's sweating hand. So in some ways, really, the novel is a mystery, and it is a mystery about where is the damn pen. Oh my God, I have to sit down. No, just kidding. So that mystery about where the pen is a real mystery in the book, but it is also, in some ways, for me, a continuation, a part of, a metaphorical part of, the mystery that is Burma. From 1962, when General Ne Win staged his coup d'etat, really until the early 90s, Burma was almost completely isolated from the West. The regime actually followed a policy of isolationism. So there was very little contact with the outside world. And Westerners who travel there now are still not really permitted to visit certain areas. And like anywhere in any country, even our own, it is hard to see the violations if you don't know where to look. And Burmese people, accustomed to 43 years of severe censorship and undercover military surveillance in every neighborhood, certainly don't come up to smiling tourists to tell them what's really going on. Burma is a mysterious place. It is so beautiful, and the people are so hospitable and so welcoming, and yet it is also a country that is so profoundly violated. And yet, what about those smiles that turn to you, those faces that turn to your face as you cross the street or sit down in a tea shop or walk into a marketplace? A lot of you must know those faces, those smiles from your own travels in different parts of the world, those eyes that look at you so directly. Their aliveness is almost shocking. In most Western cities, we rarely meet eyes in public, and if we do, our gazes tend to be a bit furtive and fleeting. You know, we don't tend to smile at each other in public if we don't know each other, because otherwise we fear people will think we are crazy. But in Burma, people smile at you. So, such dazzling, dazzling smiles. And it became part of my work in some ways to find out what those smiling faces would tell me. I had to make time for them. And I figured out, you know, where to scratch so that the gold would come off the golden land, which is one of the things that Burma has been called. And of course, the stories come out. And those stories that I found in Burma are certainly part of this novel. Those stories went into this book, The Lizard Cage. And I found that once people started to talk, once people trusted me enough to speak and to talk about their experiences, they often did not want to stop. And it was important that I could hear them. It was important that I could record what they were telling me. And I came to understand that listening itself is an act, the way that seeing is an act. One of the things that Burmese people taught me was how to see beyond beauty, how to see beyond what I wanted to see, and how to listen to more than what I wanted to hear. You know, there is that story beneath a story for all of us. You know, we're not, none of us are perfect, unscarred human beings. So, of course, many of us have that story underneath the daily story. And the first place where I really learned about that, strangely enough, was in Burma and on the Thai-Burmese border. So it allowed me to return to my own country with a different way of understanding where I lived and where I was from and what the stories might actually be here. And of course, as I think I've been trying to say this evening, there was a sense of responsibility and obligation in listening to those stories and seeing those faces. And at the same time, in doing that work, there was sometimes great despair in it and great sadness. But there was also great tenderness in it and joy as well. What was really amazing to me to learn was how brave so many people are, and what extraordinary senses of humor people had. And though I was often sad on the border and often sad in Burma, I also spent so much of my time laughing with people and felt that I was living in the realm of their kindness, as opposed to the other way around. You know, one time I went to talk to some refugees in a camp that actually has been moved. It no longer exists. and the refugees to honor my presence. Refugees, I mean, you have to remember, these people are the poorest of the poor. They really have nothing. They cooked a chicken for me. You know, they slaughtered one of their precious chickens and cooked this chicken. And I was absolutely astounded by that generosity. And that was a common thing, to experience that generosity from these people who had so little. You know, people who had been brutalized and hounded and violated repeatedly were still so kind and open and hopeful. And if they were not quite hopeful, they were certainly determined, and their anger had not obliterated their humanity. Every day I would meet these people, and the mystery of their goodness seemed as great to me as the mystery of the very real evil, the utter brutality of the soldiers, the interrogators, the imprisoners. And over the years, I spent transforming these stories, their stories, learning from them, and fashioning them into a novel. I came to understand that mystery is simply our mystery, the human mystery. That is also us, the possibility of us, if the accident of our geography had taken place elsewhere. You could be the refugee. I could be the torturer. To face that truth is also our burden. After all, we have all been the bystander, the reasonable person in the middle, who just happens not to hear, not to speak, not to see those people, the invisible ones, those who live on the other side of the border. To finish, I would like to read a border letter, or a border poem or song, really. And this is something that Teza writes to his brother on the border. Dear brother, here where all the doors are closed, I have learned to walk through brick walls. A copper pot spider was my good friend, and many lizards fed my heart. Now every dream I see assumes the shape of a skeleton key. Once I heard grandfather's voice calling me back through the trees, but I can't go home that way. I will return by an older path, over the plain, on the river, my offerings as I travel through the city of temples will be bones and tears. Everything shattered is sharp and often shines. A sliver of glass in the hand can make the history that alters history, here in the cage and there in your cramped room, in that house without nation. The new country is no distance away at all. Sometimes I almost see it growing like a web, now invisible, now suddenly shining. Brother, here where the flesh becomes spirit, the borders dissolve with the flayed skin. Here there is no separation. Sometimes I fear for you. Will you enter a new era, only to make up another word for murder? I cannot see the weapons you carry, only that warped guitar. As for me, I have forsaken every weapon but the voice, singing its last song. And the hand, dear brother, my own hand, writing it down with metta, which is Buddhist compassion, Teza. Thank you. You're very welcome.
you're willing to have some questions and mm-hmm. respond to them?
Sure.
Good. Are there some questions or comments from the floor for Karen?
That's an interesting comment. So what's the question exactly? Sorry. You're just asking me to comment on that?
Yes.
I don't know if I can. Did everybody hear what he said?
No,
of course not. I will try and repeat that. It wasn't exactly a question. You were saying that both in Greece and in Burma, people have completely assimilated, completely assumed fully the religious conditioning that they've grown up under as a culture, as a people, as a society. And what was the rest of it? Mm-hmm.
Breaking clear of that conditioning.
Mm-hmm. And outside the box is to also to become free, to become free of borders is also to break free of that conditioning. Well, I don't think that's happened in either place, as you were saying. But I do think that in Burma, Buddhism has actually been used to the better of the people in terms of politics, simply because there are quite a few Buddhist monks in Burma who are very anti-regime, who are very anti-dictatorship. And there is a new form of Buddhism growing up now in Southeast Asia. Perhaps not so strongly in Burma. I don't know. I can't speak to that. That is thought of as engaged Buddhism, as a kind of political Buddhism that seeks to break away from that sense of total acceptance that many Southeast Asian Buddhists have about their conditions. But Buddhism is such a huge part of Burmese culture, as Greek Orthodoxy is such a huge part of Greek culture, that to envision or to imagine anytime soon a full divorce of the culture from those religions, I'm sure most people can't even imagine that. Most Burmese or most Greek people can't imagine that. I mean, it happens, but I think what has happened more, again, and I know more about Burma, really, in terms of religion, is that the religion has become a tool to be used against the military regime. It's become a kind of organizing, a way of organizing and a way of thinking against the regime, as opposed to always accepting. And the regime has recognized this. The military regime of Burma, SPDC, the State Peace and Development Council, have recognized this, and they have really, in the last few years, tried to bribe and to buy out the more well-known monks. They have tried to get the Sangha, the religious order of the Buddhists, more on their side. So what the true story is in terms of Burmese Buddhism, I don't really know, but I've certainly talked with many with many Buddhists who are very, very not many Buddhists, but many Sangha members, many monks who are very, very anti-dictatorship. So that's kind of what you were asking.
Last question over here.
Yes, have you been able to penetrate the border? Have you been in the depths of Burma in the last 5 years?
Have I been in the depths of Burma in the last 5 years? I have been to Rangoon and Mandalay in the last 5 years, but I have not gone. I have not tried to get into those areas in the country that people are not allowed to go to. You know, my work there has tended to be to try and find particular people who are politically active and or who are artists and very articulate about the state of the country, both culturally and politically, and talk to them. So I haven't tried to do anything dangerous, per se.
Up there?
I did learn Burmese, but I'm ashamed to admit it's not very good. Sorry. I do. If they're Thai, or their English is not as good as mine. Wait a second. If they can't speak Thai or English very well, then I will struggle along in Burmese. But my Burmese is not fluent by any. Yes, Burma was a colony, a British colony. And so certainly before Ne Win's time, a lot of people learned English quite wonderfully. And after Ne Win came in, Ne Win being the dictator who staged a coup d'etat in 1962, you know, part of the isolationism of Burma was to close down the English schools, was to kick out all the English businesses, et cetera, et cetera.
I think we can take one more question. Is that enough time? Over here, Ruth.
Does the Burmese triangle still exist as it did in what time?
Does the Burmese triangle still exist as it did at one time? It does, because it is actually a geographical triangle up at the top of Thailand. Actually, is there somebody here who knows exactly where the Burmese Triangle is? Here we go. So Burma, Laos, and Thailand, that little area where there is a literal triangle. And it still exists, and of course, I mean, one of the things that we should be most interested in Burma for is the production of heroin, because, or of the processing of opium, at least, because after Afghanistan, they are the biggest producers of opium in the world, and all of that opium comes through Vancouver. It does indeed. I know that sounds amazing, but that's where it comes, right here to the city. Costs us a lot of money.
I'm going to ask Hector Williams to give the thank you. Hector, as I'm sure everyone here knows, is our famous archaeologist, and he met Karen in Greece, where he was doing his archaeological digs, and Karen was doing her writing.
Is there a dance or something that happens?
No.
No, it's a tradition for presidents or past presidents, which I am one of the Vancouver Institute, to thank the speaker. The Vancouver Institute, as those of you who are regulars here know, bring you different speakers on different topics every week during the term. And as the weeks go by this term, we've heard a variety of speakers, especially the last 3 weeks, where we have had Gary Geddes and Ronald Wright, and this evening, Karen Connolly. The richness of their writing comes across in their various talks, but I think tonight's was particularly valuable for us all in three different ways. Many of us have only vague notions about Burma, Road to Mandalay, where the flying fishes play and the dawn comes up like thunder out of China across the bay. And poems of Rudyard Kipling and the Burmese wars of the 19th century, and U Thant, the third Secretary General of the United Nations. But somehow, since the time of Ne Win in 1962, Burma has rather fallen off the radar screen. We hear lots about Thailand. Many people go there. Even Laos is getting tourists now. Vietnam has a huge and thriving tourist industry. You can take a cruise there now. But the first level of this evening's presentation brought us Burma again. The second level was to present to us some of the images, both literal and figurative, of the people there who are trying to fight a dictatorial regime. And you never mentioned the acronym of that regime, SLORC. Sounds like a villain out of Star Wars, but that is the acronym for the ruling council in Burma, and you brought that to us tonight as well. But I think most importantly, and this is where the Vancouver Institute tries to be different, you brought to us how an author goes about creating a work, how one goes about creating those 512 pages of The Lizard Cage. And I just learned from Karen Connolly today that The Lizard Cage, in fact, is only available in Canada. The Dutch edition will be out before the American and the English editions are, so get it and read it here. And her talk this evening has shown in a variety of ways how she herself, over the last 10 years, has put the pieces together to come out with a book that has been extremely well reviewed, and I hope that some or perhaps all of you will read and you have a chance to buy it outside. So on behalf of everybody here, thank you very much.